especially welcome if you're visiting with us. Two cowboys were riding across the prairie to church one Sunday morning, and they were singing and whistling as they rode. They were very happy. They got to the little church on the edge of town, and they took their seats, and they heard the preacher preach through all 10 of the Ten Commandments. And so when they rode home, they were very subdued, very quiet, until one of them finally said, "Well, I've never made any graven images." The other said, "Well, I guess I haven't either." And with that, they began to whistle again and sing, and by the time they got home, they were as happy as when they left. That second commandment in the King James Version, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image," that's one that a lot of people find comfort in, because that's one of the few that a lot of people feel they don't really have any difficulty with. And I have to say that I don't think I have either. I've been tempted to take some wood or stone or metal and shape it into something and set it up in the main room of my house or in my garden, and then go and bow before it and kiss it and bring gifts to it. It's just not something that I have to battle with, and I suspect it's not much of a temptation for you either. And so maybe some of you are looking forward to this morning's lesson more than others because you think it might not bother too much in your life. Or maybe you're thinking maybe we should just skip the second commandment in our studies of the second commandment, because what could that possibly, what relevance could that possibly have to us? Just you wait. I think when we have what the Lord has taught us and revealed to us in the New Testament, I think we can find relevance even in this second commandment. And I think especially we can find some things that are helpful to us in helping other people. If maybe it's not something we struggle with in our lives, there are many around us who do, and we can help to show them the truth. I'd like us to first read that second commandment in Exodus chapter 20 and the elaboration of it that's given in the text. And then we're going to address some questions about the second commandment. So Exodus chapter 20, and we're going to read verses 4 through 6 in the New American Standard Version, because that's the version of those tablets, right, that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai. So we'll get it very original here. Exodus 20, verse 4. "You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations to those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." In the 17th century in England, many Christians took this commandment very seriously and very literally. These words here about not making any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters under the earth was taken so literally, so strictly, that many Christians believe this was forbidding artwork of any kind. And any kind of they believe that having any kind of sculpture or engraving or painting, even on the walls and furniture of your home, was wrong. And so many of the Puritan homes were very plain and very bare because of how they took this second commandment. Does this commandment forbid artistry and sculpting in general? I really think they misinterpreted the second commandment. For one, because God himself, in the design that he gave the people of Israel for his tabernacle and later his temple, involved various kinds of artwork and embroidery and wood carving and metal casting. You remember on the Ark of the Covenant, the It had the pure gold cherubim with their wings stretched out over the ark. On the inner curtains of the tabernacle were woven pictures of cherubim. And the cups of the lampstand were shaped like almond blossoms. And then in the temple of God that Solomon built, that God approved of and God was pleased with, on the walls and the doors of the temple, there were cherubim and palm trees and open flowers that were carved into the walls, and then they were overlaid with gold. At the tops of the pillars of the temple were pomegranates. And then there was the great big bronze laver, the immersing pool for the priests, and it was held by 12 oxen. And there were other images made after the likeness of things in the natural world, and all of that was okay. Another example, in Numbers 21, there's a weird story. The people of Israel were again griping and complaining about their food and their accommodations out in the desert, and God was tired of it, and so he sent poisonous serpents to bite the people. And so people were actually falling down dead all over the place from snake bites. And so Moses and the people cried out to God for deliverance from these snakes. And Moses said, all right, or God said, here's what I'll do. Moses, I want you to make a bronze snake and set it up on a standard or a pole. And if anybody's bit by a snake, if they will look at this bronze serpent, they'll be healed. I'll let them live. And sure enough, if somebody was bit by a snake and they started cramping and swelling and hurting, if they could make their way and look at this snake, they'd be healed. It's a weird story, I know, but you notice that having a bronze snake, that wasn't necessarily wrong to have a graven image like that. But look with me over at 2 Kings. I think we can see that, so you've got Samuel before and then Chronicles after. 2 Kings chapter 18, if I remember right. Yeah, 2 Kings 18. I think we can see it's not necessarily wrong to have an image of some sort. It's not forbidding artistry and sculpting in general. But look here in 2 Kings. This talks about the deeds of King Hezekiah, king of Judah. He was a good king. And he was an iconoclast. He was a smasher of idols that were used for worship. 18:3. He, King Hezekiah, did right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places and broke down the sacred pillars and cut down the Asherah. And then notice this. He also broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the sons of Israel burned incense to it. You see, that bronze serpent was fine when it was just something that they looked at and something that reminded them of that time when they were grumbling in the wilderness and God sent the serpents. And then when they cried to God, God had compassion on them and he saved them from the serpents. It was fine when it was just, you looked at it and it reminded you of that occasion. But that bronze serpent became a problem when people started worshiping it by burning incense to it. I think this second commandment is forbidding making and using images for worship, making and using images to represent deity or some other power, and worshiping and serving them, those deities or higher powers through or by means of these images. Let's take an example from our modern world that might help us wrestle through what this second commandment's referring to. Probably all of us would agree that there's no problem with having a puppet or a figurine or a flannel graph or a drawing of the Apostle Peter for teaching the kids downstairs. Nothing wrong with having images as teaching aids or to remind you of something, or to brighten up your home, some reason like that. But what if a statue of St. Peter, like the one that stands in Vatican City, has the bronze toes worn off it by people kissing them? And people bow before that statue, and people pray before that statue to St. Peter. Is that a violation of the second commandment? A lot of people say no. You just look on the internet and you'll find lots of articles and they say no. And from what I gather, their argument is twofold. They'll say, first of all, that they're not really kissing and bowing and praying to the statue. They're kissing and bowing and praying to who the statue represents. They're not bowing to the bronze, they're bowing to St. Peter. Okay? The problem with that is that all religions, even in paganism, they will all say that we're not bowing to the stone or the metal, we're bowing to who the stone or metal represents. In fact, in Exodus chapter 32, you have that occasion of when the people of Israel made that golden calf while Moses was up Mount Sinai receiving more of the word of God for the people. And after they'd made that golden calf and set it up and they'd built an altar before it, Aaron sent out a proclamation to all the people of Israel saying, "Tomorrow will be a feast to the Lord. Tomorrow will be a feast to Yahweh, Jehovah." You see, the people, as far as they were concerned, they were not worshiping the gold statue. As far as they were concerned, they were worshiping Jehovah. The statue was to represent Jehovah that has brought them out of Egypt. But even though they didn't think they're really worshiping the gold, that they're worshiping God, that didn't matter. Moses still had to plead with God not to destroy the people. And Moses came down the mountain in anger and he tore down the calf and he melted it and he ground it to powder and he scattered it over the people's drinking water and he made them drink it so that it would be nothing but excrement the next day. And so I think the question is not whether you think that you're worshiping the stone or metal or wood or what it represents. It's granted that you're worshiping what it represents. And that's what everyone, I think, in the other religions that do that would say. But the other part of the argument is that they say we're not worshiping Peter. It's not worship, it's veneration, is the word that I saw was commonly used. Because we don't believe that Peter's God. We know Peter's not God. And so we are paying him reverence and adoration as just one who is great and one who's exalted and one they believe he can obtain various blessings for us. And so he's prayed to. Where's the line between worship and veneration? Do you have to think that somebody is God for prostrating yourself before them or kissing their feet or praying to them to be worshiped? In Exodus 20 here, in verse 5, where my version translates, "You shall not worship them," literally it reads, "You shall not bow down to them." And many of your versions, if you have the NIV or the New King James or the ESV, many of the very respected versions will say, "You shall not bow down to them." Acts chapter 10, verse 25, I think it is, where Peter, when he's alive on earth, he comes into the house of Cornelius. And Cornelius, when he sees Peter, he falls to his feet and prostrates himself to express reverence to Peter. And Cornelius did not think that Peter is God. He knew Peter's not God. But he saw him as someone that's great, somebody that's worthy of this kind of thing. And Peter said, "Get up. I'm a man just like you." You remember the Apostle John made that mistake a couple times in the book of Revelation? This mighty angel was standing before him, and he was in awe of this angel, and he was in awe of the visions that this angel was seeing him or was showing to him. And on two different occasions, John fell at the feet of the angel to worship him. He knew the angel's not God. He just, as somebody great and somebody worthy, and he fell down to express that to the angel. And both times the angel said, "Do not do that. I'm a fellow servant. Worship God, period." So my conviction is that the second commandment forbids us to bow to kiss, to pray to burn incense to offer sacrifices to set food before, to bring gifts to any graven image, is how I take the second commandment. You're reasonable people, think through that. See if that's what God has in mind when he gives that commandment. Now, another question to ask of this, is this second commandment, is it saying really anything different from the first one? Because there's been many throughout history who have seen what we would call the first and second commandment is really just two ways of saying the same thing. They think that verses 4 through 6 that we read at first is just an elaboration of verse 3 that we studied last Sunday. Augustine, in the early 5th century, he believed that the way he numbered these commandments, verses 2 through 6 was his first commandment. He believed all those was one commandment, but he still counted 10 commandments here because the not coveting command down in verse 17, he divided into two. And so his 9th commandment was, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. And his 10th commandment was, you shall not covet your neighbor's house or any of his property. And from what I understand, Roman Catholics and Lutherans have accepted Augustine's counting of the 10 commandments. And so the ones that we call the first and second, they just see as one, though they divide verse 17 a little differently than Augustine. Their 9th is, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, and their 10th is, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or any of his property. I guess the Jews also, from the early centuries A.D., have seen what we'd call commandment 1 and 2 as just one. But are they really just saying the same thing? I think maybe with a couple examples we could see that, you know, they are both forbidding forms of idolatry, but they're not the same. That you could obey one while at the same time be disobeying the other. You take, for example, Exodus 32, the golden calf incident. As far as the people were concerned, they were not worshiping any other god besides Jehovah who brought them out of the land of Egypt. You know, the first commandment, you shall have no other gods besides me. They said, got it. They thought they were just worshiping the one God, but they violated the second commandment because they made a graven image to represent him. Let me give you another example. If you go over to 2 Kings chapter 10. 2 Kings 10. We read about when Jehu destroyed the worship of Baal in the land of Israel. Baal was a pagan god. And to do that, he did it was a dirty little trick, sort of. He sent word throughout the land of Israel that he wanted to worship this god Baal more than anybody has ever worshipped him. And there was going to be this great worship assembly for Baal in his temple. And every worshiper of this god was to attend this assembly. And so on the day of the assembly, the temple of Baal was packed with worshipers. And Jehu gave all the worshipers new robes, and they were all excited about how things were going. And Jehu told all the worshipers there, look around and make sure there's no worshipers of Jehovah here. We don't want any of them in this assembly. And then Jehu told the men that he had surrounding the place to take out their swords and kill every single one of the worshipers of Baal that came that day. And then look at what it says, verse 26 and 27. They brought out the sacred pillars of the house of Baal and burned them. They also broke down the sacred pillar of Baal and broke down the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day. Kind of graphic, isn't it? One day it's the focus of worship and the other day it's the focus of other things. And people would walk by and they'd say, you know, that's where they used to worship Baal. Jehu sure dealt with that, didn't he? You see, Jehu was concerned that everybody worshiped the right god and no other god. So far, so good. Verse 28. Thus Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. But the first word in verse 29, however, is important. It means what he did was good, but here's something that was not so good. However, as for the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin, from these Jehu did not depart, even the golden calves that were at Bethel and that were at Dan. These golden calves were set up to represent Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of Israel. And so he did good in making sure everybody's just going to worship the one true God. He saw that only one God's worthy of worship. But then he made a hash of the second commandment by thinking that the true God could be represented with these images and he could be worshipped through these images. And so we need to understand that idolatry consists not only of the worship of false gods, not only in giving your love and devotion to things that are not God, but also in worshiping the true God by means of graven images. Well, what's wrong with having images to represent God? Well, think about it. Can you imagine anything that is equal with God? And so anything that we come up with to sculpt or build or paint to represent God would be less than God really is. Any sculpture, any painting, any image would do nothing but just diminish and demean who God really is. Let me read to you some words from Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah 40, verse 12, "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and marked off the heavens by the span, and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure, and weighed the mountains in a balance, and the hills in a pair of scales? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has informed him? With whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding? And who taught him in the path of justice, and taught him knowledge, and informed him of the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket, and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust." Go down to verse 18. "To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. A goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. It is he who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless." And he goes on in verse 24, "He merely blows on them and they wither, and the storm carries them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me that I would be his equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these stars, the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing." How could you possibly create anything that approximates to the creator and sustainer of the heavens and the earth? The greatest piece of art that anyone could possibly come up with would just be a gross insult to God. It would be a terrible misrepresentation of him. And nobody likes bad pictures of themselves. And especially God, because the way that people view God has tremendous bearing on how they live and how they treat other people. So God says, no images. And here's where maybe we can get more relevant to ourselves. I don't think you have to have just physical stuff to construct an unworthy image of God and violate the principles of the second commandment. I think we can fashion an unworthy image of God in the factory of our minds. And we can worship and serve that image, and it's idolatry. And I think that's why the little book in the New Testament of 1 John ends the way that it does. That book of 1 John, some of you I think are studying that on Sunday mornings. So you probably know it has to do with a certain false teaching that presented a different Jesus than the real Jesus. And from what I glean in the book of 1 John, the teaching said something about Jesus Christ did not come in the flesh. It says that deity did not really become a flesh and blood human being. And it permitted, the teaching permitted a sinful lifestyle and not loving your brother. And so John writes that letter to deal with that and to assure his Christian readers that they have the truth, they have eternal life, they have fellowship with God and with His Son. And then he ends that letter with this statement. He says, "This is the true God and eternal life. Little children, guard yourselves from idols." And I don't think that that's just a random exhortation that came to John's mind as he ended the letter and he decided to throw it in right at the end, and it has nothing to do with anything he said before. I think instead that's a summarizing exhortation. Because the view of God and the view of Jesus that the false teachers were bringing was an unworthy image of God. It was an idol. Guard yourselves from idols means keep yourself from perversions of God and perversions of Jesus. And if you have this perversion of image of God and you worship and serve that, it's idolatry. I think people can portray idolatry in their minds in things that they say. Former Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, South Africa, Desmond Tutu, was reported in the daily newspapers of Cape Town, South Africa, as having made statements like, "My God is not homophobic. I could not worship a God that's against homosexuals." And he went on to say, if homosexuals are not going to heaven, then I don't want to go there either. Where did he get this image of God that he's okay with the homosexual lifestyle? I guarantee you he did not get it from what God's revealed about himself in his word. He has created this image of God in the factory of his own mind according to his liking. Or another unworthy image of God that some people have is that he's a hard, callous, severe individual that delights in catching people in sin and punishing them, that he's just waiting and hoping that we'll mess up so that he can punish us. Well, that's a gross misrepresentation of God. Or some people go to the other extreme, and you know it's a common image if you've been to very many funerals. And it doesn't matter what the person believed, it doesn't matter how they lived, somebody will stand up and say, "I know that so-and-so is in heaven." And it's common for people to have this image of God that he is a permissive, indulgent grandfather that's always willing to look the other way, that when human beings are still are rebellious and rejecting of him and willfully practicing sin in their lives, that he'll just keep smiling and wink at that and would never send anybody to a place called hell. But they've made an image of God and set it up in the shrine of their minds. They've made an image according to their own desires. We have to be careful that our view of God is not a product of our fertile minds or anybody else's minds, but we get our view of God from what God's revealed about himself in his word and in Christ. Christ is the image of God. 2 Corinthians 4:4. He is the exact representation of his nature. Hebrews 1 and verse 3. You remember his conversation with Philip the night of his betrayal, and Philip is saying, "Jesus, just show us the Father. Just give us a glimpse of the Father." And that'll be enough for us. And Jesus goes, Philip, I've been with you 3 years, and you still don't know who I am. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He shows us the nature and the character of God. And so our view of God, it must come from the image that God has given us. And we can't push that aside and make up our own image like so many do, or that's idolatry. I think that violates the principles of the second commandment. Let's end here just looking at the reasons that are given in Exodus 20 for why we need to comply with the second commandment. Look at the first statement that God makes about himself, Exodus 20 and in verse 5. He says, For I, the Lord God, am a jealous God. And some people might argue, well, I'm still worshiping God. I'm not worshiping any other God. This image just helps me to worship God. It just aids me in my worship of God. So why would God be jealous about that? Well, picture a newly married couple. And they're very in love, very happy. They've only been married for 3 weeks. They're still infatuated with each other. They still get butterflies every time they see each other. And the husband comes home from work early one afternoon, and he fixes up the house a little bit, and he gets started on dinner. And then the wife comes in, and they hug and kiss, and she thanks him for starting on dinner. And then she says, I'm going to go change my clothes, and then I'll come help you peel potatoes. And he says, great. And you'll notice that I've put up some new decorations on the wall in our room. And she goes in there to see what he's done. And lo and behold, his great idea was to go down to the Photoshop and blow up some pictures of his old high school and college girlfriends. And he's framed them, and he set them up on their wall in their room. And she comes out and says, What is that? And he can see she's not happy. And he says, What's the problem? What do you mean, what's the problem? You put pictures of your old girlfriends on the wall in our room. I thought you loved me. I thought you were devoted to me. I thought you said you will forsake all others and keep yourself to me and to me only, so long as we both shall live. And he says, Well, yeah, you're taking this all wrong. Those pictures are all about my love for you. Those pictures help me to love you. Sometimes I like to think of you as a blonde school teacher named Sue. And sometimes I like to think of you as a redheaded dental hygienist named Jessica. And thinking of you in these ways, it helps me to love and to serve you. It's all about you. Would you buy that? Would you accept that? He's ruined his marriage. Because she knows that if he says, I love you, but he's thinking of Sue, then he doesn't mean he loves her, he means he loves Sue. And if he's thinking of Jessica when he's buying flowers, he's not really buying flowers for her, he's buying flowers for Jessica. When we have some image that we've made that doesn't look like God, that's different from God, and anything we come up with on our own for God is not going to look like God, and we worship and serve that image, we're not worshiping and serving God, we're worshiping and serving this other imaginary being that we've made up. And so it provokes God to jealousy like a betrayed spouse. So I'm a jealous God, he says. So that's one reason. And then notice the next statement that God makes about his nature. He says, keep going there in verse 5, and he says, I visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And so he's telling us, I am not a permissive, indulgent grandfather that's always looks the other way. I will deal justly with those who hate me. And this is not a passage that says that God will punish children and grandchildren that are innocent for the sins that only their fathers and their grandfathers committed. Because many other places, God says, I absolutely will not do that. He holds people responsible only for their own sins, like Ezekiel 18:20. It says the person who sins will die. The Son will not bear punishment for the Father's iniquity, nor will the Father bear punishment for the Son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. And you also notice here in Exodus 20 that this third and first, you know what it is, it's the fourth generation that he will visit the iniquity on, that he'll punish. They're not innocent. He says, on the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. I think what God is saying is that he will not excuse people for hating him and disobedience just because it's the family tradition that they were brought up in. Even though they're just doing what they saw their father do and their grandfather do and their great-grandfather do, they're just imitating their way of life, God will not excuse it because they've just accepted the religion of their father. But then notice the complementary aspect of God's nature. Verse 6. I'm almost done. Verse 6. I show loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. And I think he means thousands of generations. And he's saying that his loving kindness is never exhausted. There will never be a generation that God doesn't have any more loving kindness for. And so the generations before us did not use up God's loving kindness. God will still do for us what he did for those that we read about in Bible times, if like them, we love God and we keep his commandments. Well, let's stand together and let's sing. And if we could pray for you, or if you need to make something known or whatever we can do, please come while we sing together.